Halton here. At MSA, our health and safety drives them to develop advanced safety equipment with performance and protection in perfect balance, like Globe Athletics, the latest innovation in turnout gear. Developed as athletic gear for firefighters, Athletics uses unique stretch fabrics that provide body contoured fit for unprecedented range of motion and flexibility. It's lighter weight, less bulky, and provides the protection you need from your turnout gear. Get the full story at msafire.com/globe.
This class today is called Firefighter Mental Health Awareness. It is put on by the HERD Group. The HERD Group is basically our family, and I call Dustin part of that family. This is important. It's significant. It's a topic we want to talk about and something we want to make sure you're aware of. So as we get started today, I want to ask a few questions. And Dustin and I, you know, obviously we're in different locations, but we'll try to make sure we don't speak all over each other, but we do want to make sure we interact the way we normally do because Dustin and I are so funny and humorous all the time, and we just get each other's jokes, and it's perfect, all that stuff. But on this technology, it may not be sometimes, so we ask you to be patient with us. But in the background of firefighting, the question is, what did we learn? And Dustin, what are some of the basics that every person who's ever gone through Fire Academy has learned in that Fire Academy?
Well, first one, we talk about the traditional, no running on the fire ground, rank and file, chain of command, always having a safety, always having a backup. And the interesting thing is a lot of those preparedness tools that we do utilize and are paramount for our fire ground survival chain can also be crossed over and used into the mental wellness section if we just make some adaptive shifts. One of the things we weren't told initially the fire services about the psychological, the emotional impact that does actually relate into tangible physical deficits. We never really told about those things. And we're going to talk, moving through this about some of the changes that have been made to minimum standards and the educational content and curriculum and how that has changed the way we approach the humans that happen to be firefighters in the fire service. So, Jeremy?
Yeah, I love the way you said that, too, because we talk, that's kind of the approach we want you all to get to, and we will discuss it multiple times, is the fact that you are a human who happens to be a firefighter. This firefighting cannot be your be-all, end-all. It can be your life's calling, it can be your vocation, it can be your passion, but it cannot be your identity. And so we talk about that a lot, want to make sure you're aware of that. But we joke a lot about the fact that when Dustin and I first started talking about this mental health stuff, it was out of tragedy, which we're going to share with you in a little while. But we started laughing about the fact that you spend 480 hours, minimum standards. And out of those 480 hours, I don't know what the number is, but the amount of time I spent tying ropes and knots and learning those ropes and knots had to be, double digits at least, I'm guessing, between that and practice time. And I can't think of a time that I've actually used it on a call. Now, I obviously worked at fire stations where we didn't have the type of calls that were leading to that. But that's just one example of those types of things that we spent so much time on. And the running joke is if you're a boater, you definitely use those knots because you actually were able to kind of figure out how to use those on your boat and anchoring something off and things like that. But there's a lot of these things that we learned that may not have a practical application. However, we don't want to minimize that. Listen, we understand there are things you learn in Fire Academy, things I learned in Fire Academy that have literally saved my life, that have allowed me to continue on, but also allowed me to help others. So we don't want to discount that, but we do want to make sure you understand, we know that firefighter mental health has not been something that's been focused on in the past. And for us, Dustin and I had the privilege of being a part of the Florida State Fire College in setting up the Bureau of Safety and Training Standards that allowed us to put together a 4-hour curriculum. Now, that sounds like a very little amount, but they took 8 hours out of the 480-hour curriculum and put 4 hours towards mental health and then 4 hours towards cancer prevention, firefighter safety, and health. That's huge. It's at least a start for us because now there is a curriculum that allows firefighters walking into this career knowing some of the basics. Instead of in the past when we all went through Fire Academy or EMT or paramedic, it might have been, hey, don't get stressed. Watch out for burnout. And that was really kind of the conversation. So we have made some strides. But what we want to discuss today is There's a new era. There's a new way of doing this. And so I want to give credit to some of the people who have worked and set the platform for this. There are individuals who really put the time in. And Bobby Halton, that FDIC fire engineering editor, worked for Penwell, one of the leading experts in the fire service. I believe he's in his 70s and has been doing this for a long, long time in multiple departments. He gets it. He understands it. And he has pushed this agenda throughout. Dan DeGrice, who just retired out of Chicago, battalion chief, has made sure that we have this opportunity. He runs the Florian, Rosecrans Florian program up in Illinois, which is for firefighters. It's a recovery program for firefighters only, and firefighters, first responders, military, and that's what he focuses on. He makes sure that's the case. On top of that, Dina Ali and this other guy, Dustin Hawkins. I want to make sure Dustin gets some credit because Dina and Dustin, I believe, are a powerhouse in this because they are two people who are younger in this career than the two I just mentioned, who have made it a passion to focus on peer support and chaplaincy and assisting others, and they make a difference. Dina's out of North Carolina, does a phenomenal job. She's working on some peer support that's going to be offered down here in Florida soon. She's by the way, our suicide awareness expert. This woman gets it, has all the stats. Paul Combs, who does these cartoons, obviously a different way of sharing about the firefighter world and fire service culture. Mike Gagliano is a retired firefighter out of Seattle who focuses on families, has some great material for families and spouses and transitioning home and some of those things that we've utilized a lot. There's so many others as well, but I want to make sure you are aware of the fact that we really lean on other people, and Dustin and I spend time talking to people like Dina. We lean on these individuals and make sure that we have the right information because we want to make sure it's not just two people talking. There's some statistics, there's some data, there's some surveys that we follow and use to give us the material to be able to share this. So we're going to get into this. The first thing that we always say to everybody, we are not the experts. I love the fact that people think that because in the fire service, what we have, if you go to any conference, Atlanta, Orlando, FDIC, it doesn't matter what it is, there's always somebody who is the expert in some field in that classroom setting up to tell you how this is this latest tactic or strategy or technique or whatever it is, and this is why it's the greatest and the latest and greatest, and here's what they know about it, and here's what's going to happen with it. And then if you do research, there are some people who truly are experts who've studied it. There are others who have taken a class and, all right, I'm good. I got it. I know it. And you're going, no, that's not how it works. And for us, it's the same thing. We have to make sure that we understand we are not your experts. We simply are sharing from our experiences what we've learned, and we've learned it from a lot of other people. So what we try to do is get people to understand we are here to facilitate learning with you. We want to make sure you understand it. And we want to get you to change your perspective. The perspective often is wrong place, wrong time. I was in this situation and it happened that this took place at that same moment. And oh man, I can't believe I went through that. The perspective change should be for us to be able to go, well, it's not wrong place, wrong time. It's I was in the right place, right time. We are not saying, and actually this is one of the conversations that Dina and I've had in depth. We're not saying that there's no such thing as sadness. There's no such thing as negative things that take place in your life. There are some awful, awful things that take place in our life. But how we respond to them is really a sign of our mental health and the awareness level we have of it. Our self-awareness, our mental and emotional state. So what we want you to understand is if you can possibly get to a point where you can see everything through the filter of, I was meant to get better as a result of this. And we're not going to get into some huge theological discussion or existential discussion or anything else because we could have all kinds of things about fate and destiny and faith and God's plan or whatever the case may be. We're not here to do that today. What we are here to do is to say, how do you see the things you face? And a couple of classes ago, I had a friend of mine who works with me at Palm Beach County tell her story about the worst call she had run basically 3 weeks before. And it probably would have been the worst call I would have ever run if I'd been on it. And the conversation we had was, nobody wants to go through that. But if you have the right perspective, you're able to go through it, and you're able to get better as a result of it, no matter how bad the situation was. And we're going to talk a little bit about our lives and some things we've gone through in our lives, both professionally and personally. And what we want you to understand is we're not perfect. You're going to hear the fact that we haven't actually responded the right way every time to all those moments that have come in our lives, but we've gotten better as a result. And I think we both will say, and the people around us will say, we're better for what we've been through. We are better because of how we've handled the situations that have come. Once again, not handling them all perfectly, but what we've learned through them. And that perspective changes things for us. Viktor Frankl, one of my favorite people, was a Jewish neuroscientist, and he went through the Holocaust. Basically, during that time, you could spend a lot of time talking about him. There's a book called Man's Search for Meaning, highly recommend it, that he wrote. It's called Man's Search for Meaning. And he went through the opportunity to get out of Germany before everything got bad. He chose to stay to help his people. And he ended up in a prisoner of war camp. And by the time the war was over, he was the only person left in his family. So everybody else was killed by the Nazis. He's left. And he goes on through his life, and there's a point later where they ask him about that moment, and he says, when you have something happen to you, it's a stimulus. And between stimulus and every stimulus, there's a response. Between stimulus and response, there's a space. In that space lies your power to choose, and in that power lies your growth and your freedom. You have the opportunity every time something comes in for you to respond the right way or the wrong way. We're not saying that everything's going to be amazing and awesome and it's perfect every time it comes through. But what we want you to understand is when it does come at you and it's negative, you still have a choice to make. And as we get into this conversation, we want you to know there are some reasons why. Dustin's going to share a little bit about this because this really deals with him. This is really how Dustin and I became friends. We knew each other. We had talked before. Dustin had gone through the greatest chaplain class in the history of chaplain's classes prior to that, taught by me. It was actually the first chaplain class I ever taught. I don't think I did a very good job, but Dustin's joke was, go ahead and tell him, Dustin. It was something along the lines of, oh, I learned everything I needed to learn in that class or something like that, right?
Well, the irony is when I met you, you know, we didn't realize, I think, until we started communicating and connecting that you and I've known each other coming up on 18 plus years.
Yeah.
And it was the irony of just life paths crossing a long time ago in an ER, and then meeting again. But one of the things that I always like to cover and bust, you know, Jeremy's chops about is, yes, he was actually my instructor for the chaplaincy program.
I'm sorry.
And yeah, as is everybody who I've ever had the opportunity to impact, has apologized for my lack of preparation in this class. But one of the things that, you know, the lesson that you did teach, and you and I haven't really talked about this a whole lot, so the individuals here will get to hear it for a first time, just like you will. But one of the powerful lessons that you did teach me that has served very, very well is the ministry of presence. And I honestly think the days of the class were there. We could have skipped your poor humor and poor, you know, dress, taste, and ability, and just cover that one thing is ministry of presence, is being present with another human being and how powerful that is. It also applies to some of the things we're going to cover today, which is being present with your own thoughts. But one of the things that I love messing with Jeremy is, hey, I'm sure you covered this in the class. I'm sure you did. Because it's astounding the further that we as an organization and as a family have gone down this seemingly goal-oriented mental wellness path. Well, we're going to do this, and then it'll be an achievement and a success, and we'll move on, is how long this path is and how many different things we discover. But how Jeremy and I had met is back in, I think it was 2014, 15?
For the chaplain class, yeah, I think it was 15.
Sat down and we talked, and he said, listen, I'm not gonna be able to cover absolutely everything there is here. The important thing is communicating and connecting. And as the days and weeks went on, through setting up our chaplaincy with my local union, the 2201 and Indian River County Fire Rescue, just ran into a lot of things where I just would pick up the phone and kind of like, hey, I have to call my mentor here and go, hey, and this is how the calls always start. Hey, you got a second? Yeah, sure. What's up? I'm sure that you covered this in the class, but that progressed into really realizing and diving in how big of the scope of the mental wellness related issues and suicidal ideation and addiction was in the fire service, because I had a suspicion and I was driven to serve and try and help and make a difference. And we're going to talk as we go into this where those traumas came from that shone light on the shortcomings of our current system. But really diving in and working with Jeremy and working with the collaborative, we started realizing how big this problem is. And it ended up hitting home very, very closely. You know, loss of a close personal family member in the fire service that I had served alongside for 13 years at that point. Same station, same house, same crew. and he had lost his life and completed suicide. And walking alongside of this, Jeremy and myself, and also Captain Larry Doling, who's since retired, we came together to work on this and work through the tangible effects. Today, we're going to talk about what the impacts are to the family and what the impacts are to you. But there also are a lot of other tangible effects that happen through addiction, loss, pain, and unfortunately, suicide. But this discussion is imperative because one of the things that we found, no matter how many programs, classes, protocols, safety measures that we have, that we invent, that we're still working on with universities and industry, is that the most powerful thing is it's important right here. We're talking. We're communicating about a subject that was previously very, very taboo and uncomfortable. And what I'm noticing is not only are our old salts, you know, our members with, you know, 20, 25, 35, 40 plus years of experience, multiple careers and retirements, are now talking about these impacts. But we're also now seeing it as a normal conversation for our incoming and our incumbent firefighters and first responders, not just firefighters, law enforcement, dispatch, our CSIs, our community outreach liaisons, grief counselors. We're starting to see this conversation happen. So, Jeremy, you did cover something that was very, very powerful, and that's come to fruition in the fire service, and I admire you for it, is that the Ministry of Presence, although it's the only thing that you actually covered and taught and that was worth any value in your class, is a very, very powerful tool and something that's innately that we're capable of. You just have to sometimes stop, see where we're at, and then walk towards that person and communicate and be present. You've done that many times in our relationship, and we've done that many times in helping other individuals in crisis. And I'm sure, because I say it all the time, I'm sure you covered it in your class.
Yeah, and we many of the questions that you asked were things that I immediately was like, no, we never covered that because I never thought about it. And that's what kind of happens in this world is that's why the Ministry of Presence is so powerful, because sometimes we don't know what to do because it's something that's brand new. It's never been covered before. It is something very unique, and you think, how? I never thought I would be prepared for this, or somebody would go through this in the fire service. So this picture actually is of that friend's funeral, David Dangerfield's funeral. And that was literally a week after you and I spent that basically 24 hours together walking through the pain and the anguish and the turmoil of the funeral home, the setting everything up and sitting on the back patio and talking. And Dustin's conversation with me that night was, we're doing something about this. We are going to fix this problem. We are going to make sure this doesn't happen anymore. You know, that sort of thing. And I remember thinking, how do we do that? And we've taken a lot of steps. We've done a lot of things. We've taught a lot of classes. We've definitely helped raise the awareness. And we're not the only people doing it. There's a lot of people doing a great job with it. But that's where it started for us. And that's what kind of bonded us. But it also, and that's why I always put this phrase on the screen, firefighters are dying. Because no matter how much we talked about that and prepared for that and have made an impact and an influence and fixed things, there still is an issue of people who are dying. And we have to do something about it to continue to change that. So we want people to understand that's why we're having the conversation. And when we get into the suicide awareness part of this is really kind of how this all comes to fruition. But what we want you to see is this. In the suicide awareness algorithm, there is no predictable algorithm. Dean is the one who kind of talks through this with us. Is there are a lot of people out there going, well, how do we figure this out? And there's no way for us to go, well, Dustin is 24 and has been in the fire service for 18 years. He started when he was six. And Jeremy is 72 and looks amazing for 72. Not so amazing for what my actual age is. There's an amount of divorce or the military presence or experience or how many calls we ran or how many critical incidents we ran, and we punch it all into a computer, and then think of the dot matrix, like just spits it out, and the number is there. 86% chance of struggling with suicide, 42% chance of taking his life. There's no way to do that. It doesn't work that way. We can't predict it. And it's very important for you to understand this for a couple of things. Number one, for you as an individual, there's no way for you to look at it and go, how much in danger am I? Number two, if you have someone who is struggling with this, you can't judge them and go, well, they haven't run as many calls as I've run. They haven't run the serious call. Whoa, it's not just about that. There's so much that gets added into this. So we want you to understand that. But the second part of that is it's not preventable. It's not 100% preventable, is what I should say. When I hear someone say, I'm going to teach a class called suicide prevention, I go, ooh, it makes me kind of take pause and think about it, because you're not going to ever fully 100% prevent it. And we're going to talk about that with Dave's story and how hard you work to help him. There, you can do everything in your power. And if someone chooses to do so, they're going to choose to do so. And we want you to understand that. But this is the next point. I'm going to hand this part of this over to Dustin. We had one recently here in Boynton Beach with an individual who everybody loved, and he took his life. And it doesn't mean that those statements are untrue. Because the second part of it is this: it's not inevitable. So yes, it's not completely predictable. It's not completely preventable, but it's not inevitable either. It's not. We don't want people to think, well, I'm sitting here as a firefighter, and whew, I'm a cop, I'm a dispatcher, I've seen all these things, and at some point I'm going to want to kill myself, because all firefighters do, because every first responder gets PTSD. It's like, well, hold on, that's not the case. There are people who've never struggled with it. There are people who have. And we want you to understand, this is not an epidemic, this is not inevitable. And by the way, that was a slide that had that term epidemic before we ever got to this pandemic. And now people laugh and go, wait, did you put that? And this is something we've been talking about for a long time. This isn't something sweeping across our fire departments. The numbers are not that much higher necessarily than the regular public, but we do face a very, very difficult set of circumstances. So is there anything you want to add here, Dustin? I didn't want to get ahead of myself on this, but normally when we're in the same room, you just go, you give me that eye, and it's your turn to talk, and you just talk, and I do the same thing. So go ahead.
Yeah, it's kind of weird now. We have, for the first time in our relationship, technology that's impeding our ability to read and mess with each other a little bit. But I feel like something's between us. Wholeheartedly agree. You know, there's some terminology that we always start this program out, and it's about taking the power away from a subject and topic to where we're more comfortable. And the first thing that I want to discuss is the term around suicide. Most individuals, when they refer to it, they say something that, well, they committed suicide. And everybody that's on this call today, right now, and that's going to be watching this later, I need you to take an introspective look for a second. Whether you're struggling individually with suicidal ideation, intent, or you even have a plan, or you're a survivor of a family that's been impacted or affected, or a department that's been affected by this, and working through the inevitable signs that I missed, what I could have done, how did I not know? I'm going to cover two very, very powerful points here. The first thing is how we speak about this. There is no law, and this isn't, like you said, we're going to get into spiritual debate here and biblical context. There is absolutely no law that is a punishable crime for taking your own life. There's not. Now, this is not a statement of condonement. Okay, this is not let's lose our hope and lose our drive because it's legal. Let's go ahead and take this path. The reason I say this is because when people discuss about suicide, there's this level and sense and censorship about not discussing it by quiet and hushed tones, because they say, well, they committed suicide. So what we're going to start off here is we're going to talk a little bit more about some signs and symptoms and things that I ignored individually that I was fortunate and blessed enough to have a spouse and family and my brother in the fire service that found me the day that I attempted to kill myself. But we're going to talk about the terminology here. It's completed suicide, attempted suicide. Okay, it's not committed, because when we do that, we put a sense of judgment on it, where we don't want to discuss what has happened in the past. And here's the cautionary tale that leads into the second part of this lesson about suicide awareness. Okay. There is no prevention protocol and program that we can teach everybody that's a one size fits all. And we don't know what the algorithm, what the matrix and metrics is for each individual because of where they came from in life. It's about musical notes lining up perfectly for that individual and them to hit a point of hopelessness where life as they see it could have no alternative outcome, where they start feeling that they are the epicenter of pain, of struggle, of strife, and truly believe that the friends, the family, those whom they love would be in a better place if they did not exist. The point of this perspective that I want to rest with you is we cannot stop every single soul from completing or attempting suicide. And here's why. Because there is no class to teach you every magic method and way to have your active listening and ministry of presence to make it perfect for every relationship and circumstance. And here's why. Because we cannot read each other's minds. That's why. most of the completed suicides, when we go back and talk about these in awareness and prevention, quote unquote, programs, and we go through psychological autopsies of first responders that have completed suicide or attempted suicide, the most common questions that happen are this: man, I had no idea. Why didn't you tell me? Or somebody who else is struggling: oh my gosh, this is happening to you too. I had no idea. Most first responders, prior to completing suicide, when we screen back through their last minutes, moments, weeks, months, we find out that there seems to be a sense, when we look at their lives, of re-engagement into their community or their family, where helplessness and hopelessness shifts to temporary happy before they complete suicide. And most individuals say, I had no idea. And we start looking back at all of the things that we try and put measures of saying, well, these were the signs. I should have known. Dustin was struggling for all of this time, and then all of a sudden he decided to go fishing one day. It's odd. Well, I was fortunate enough that somebody found me on the day that I tried to take my own life. But in a completed suicide, they look back and go, well, there was a love note. There was kindness. There was compassion. They took care of their insurance. They made sure that their FRS was taken care of. They made a huge change in perspective. We're going to talk a little bit about David Dangerfield. Somebody who is very isolated, all the things that Jeremy mentioned, you know, going through financial, divorce, issues at work, all of those type of things compiling, where we look at it now and go, well, that makes sense. But leading up to the day in October, when we look at this right now, we go, wow, it seems like he was getting better, seeking professional help, re-engaging, talking, communicating, going out the night before with friends and family and laughing and being jovial and joking. So what we're trying to get here is, listen, it's very easy to look back retrospectively and say, well, these were all the things leading up, and have a fear inside of us of going, how do I set up and build an effective program within my organization? Simple first steps are: change the way we speak about suicide to make it an open and safe conversation. And here's the powerful tool: recognizing that we can't read each other's minds and being willing. And this is one of the things that Jeremy has taught me and we've done together. I don't want to give him too many compliments, although he's getting larger in the waist. I don't want his head to get too large on this. I want to point out something here. Okay. One of the things that he's taught and shown
is there,
action.
Is there a way to mute Dustin while you're talking right now?
Nope. You can't do that, but I know your girls are in the background shaking their head, smiling.
Yeah, exactly.
Nobody else takes a
shot. I'm on camera and have to pretend like.
Yeah. The camera added 62 pounds. One of the things that he has done, and I've had the blessing and at times a great burden to work with hundreds and hundreds of firefighters every quarter in this, is realizing that we change the terminology, we make it comfortable, that we can't read their minds and find out what's going on in their life. And this is the powerful thing that Jeremy, that I commend you, and we want a lesson to be given into this class, is be willing to ask the question, what's going on? Are you okay? Do you have plans to harm yourself? You have a means, a mechanism to carry it out. And I know this sounds weird, because the question that we always get in these, the suicide awareness segment is, oh my God, I don't want to ask them that. What if I give them an idea? And that one time as a first responder that I worked through with intensive inpatient, IOP, aftercare, reintegration type programs, has any of them ever said, you know what was crazy? As I was just sitting down, I had nothing going on. I just had a normal, stressful day. And then this fireman, this peer support member, this chaplain, this HR member, this company officer came to me and said, wow, you seem like you're having a tough time. I noticed some things have changed and you seem to be struggling. Some things seem to be happening in your life. And I care. I see you. I want to help you without judgment. But I have to ask you something. Are you planning on killing yourself? And that individual went, oh my God, I never thought about that. It was a great idea. I had never realized that was an option. I went out to my truck. I went ahead and wrote a note and made this step-by-step plan to remove myself from life. Not one of them. Every one of them said, man, you know what? It was amazing that they asked. They actually cared enough. And then I was able to say, yeah, I'm having a tough time. Or I said, no, I wasn't having a tough time. And then I had somebody later to go back and talk to. So be willing to ask that question and be prepared for a very long pause. After you ask, it's one of the scariest pauses that any one of you guys, men and women here, are going to have to deal with, is asking a question. And this is how it's going to go. And Jeremy's done this for me. We'll talk a little bit about this when we were in Daytona walking by a hotel, where ask the question, are you okay? Tell me a little bit about this, a little bit more. Are you planning on harming yourself? And it's going to be a very long pause. It's very awkward. It's very difficult. It's going to stop your breath. But be prepared, and we're going to talk a little bit about what to do if they say yes on how to get them help. So remember, change our vernacular, It's not committed. It's not a crime. Is it heartbreaking? Yes. Completed. Did they complete suicide? Did they attempt suicide? And don't approach judgment. You don't know where they're at if you haven't had the conversation. Remember, we can't read each other's minds. So, Jeremy, sorry about the 62 pounds. I know it was only 61 pounds that you've gained, but go ahead.
Well, it's 15 if we're going to add the numbers, but we're working on bringing it back down. It's down two this week. Thank you for keeping track. The other thing I want to add to that, too, is as somebody who's asked this question a lot to people, and actually I've asked Dustin about it. The other interesting thing is when somebody isn't thinking about it at all, which you may have maybe misread the situation or heard the response. I asked Dustin one time a while back and he went, no, not that. There is no pause because they're like, no, that's not, I'm not in that place right now. So, you know, it doesn't have to be as scary either if you ask at the right time. The other thing I want you to see on this slide, actually, I meant to hit this when you saw it, is when you're worried, ask, as Dustin mentioned, because really the reality we want you to get is there's hope. There is hope for this. Once again, not preventable, 100%. There's no algorithms, not all those other things. But the bottom line that we want you to get is there's hope. There is a reason why we ask people if they're okay. There's a reason why we take the time to ask people if they're thinking of harming themselves. Because there is a hope. There is an answer. There is a way to get them better. It may not be you. You may not be the person to even get that. You may literally just get them to a person, a counselor, a therapist, a clinician, and then you're done. You may not do anything else, but that may be what it takes. And so we want you to understand that there's a reason why we talk about this. There's a reason why we have this conversation. We have to do something because it's not obvious. You have to care enough as a fellow brother or sister firefighter to watch. You have to care enough to ask, and you have to care enough to act. We teach a lot on the fact that you have to be involved in your firefighter family's lives. I always say you don't need to go down to every, you know, Dolphins game. Dolphins are no good anyway, so don't worry about it. But you don't have to go to a barbecue every weekend. You know, whatever it is, find things to do with your crew. Spend some time. Get to know them. Get to know them on shift. Even if that's all you do, spend a little time. I know with my crew at my station, a lot of times it's getting out in the bay and playing some pickleball. Just in those moments, you get to see people's character, get to have conversations. You get sore and have knees that don't work anymore when you get old. But you do what it takes to get to know people, because then when you start to see differences and changes, you can ask, you can have conversations. And the last part of this is you don't have to have all the answers. If you're the person who just simply gets them to the next level, and that's one of the reasons we give you our phone number, is if you don't know what else to do, call us. We'll take the call. And sometimes it's us just getting them onto another person. Dustin and I have handled many calls where it's a chief or an HR person or an administrator or just a friend going, here's the situation. I've got this person. They're struggling. They're thinking about taking their life. What do I do? Well, where are you at? Let's see if we can find someone in your area who can help. And a lot of times, you know, I think it was one we both helped with together years ago. It was probably 6 months later, we ran into that chief and he goes, thank you so much. That person is back on the job. And all we did was, I think I handled one call, got them to somebody. Dustin took a little, and I think he handled three or four more calls later, and then we were done. I don't think we even knew the name of the individual, but then we have this great story at the end of the chief going, hey, this is a person who's doing better now. That's what we want. I think that's the end goal, is we want to get to that point. There's a reason why this is important to us. This is Dustin after he initially had gotten burned. I remember the very first time we ever taught this, and Dustin just slid this picture in without telling me about it, and he actually made it just dropped in and bounce on the bottom on PowerPoint, and I went, oh, you're killing me. Because it's basically showing Dustin getting his arm basically cleaned up, debrided, popsicle sticks and cloths and towels and all the other things that happen for a burn injury. So normally I would tell, you know, a few minutes of Dustin's story here, but I'd like for Dustin just to share a little bit about kind of what happened here to get into this point, because there's three stories we want to talk about here to tell you kind of why this is important to us.
Back in 2014, it was right around the air show in Indian River. I was on the Marine Division. I've been there for 13 years, doing UCSI, Rough Surf Rescue, running our 28 while working on our boat just for annual service, you know, going through all of our safety protocols and procedures, much like we talk about minimum standards. We have all of these things set in place to keep us safe. And a lot of those safety protocols came from previous injuries and incidents. You know, somebody lost a hand. Hey, why don't we put a placard out about, let's put on some gloves. Somebody got hit in the head. Why don't we wear a helmet? So all of those different things were in place. And while working on the boat, we had no idea that we had a fuel leak in our port nacelle, and it was in a sealed compartment or a sealed area of the boat, a cell that was non-serviceable, and it saturated the foam on the boat. And we had a poly plug, and fate and circumstance would work out. The poly plug had disintegrated while we were using an electric powered Phillips head screw gun to remove the pony pump, which every year we remove and swap it out, and salt water eats them up pretty quickly. The boat ignited, and I was trapped in the hull, and my crew got to watch me burn. So I sustained second and third degree burns. I've got full sleeve xenografting, pig skin. For any firefighters on the group, you're not the first one to think about bacon jokes. My crew made me a 5-pound bacon man when I came back to work. It was a very nice touch. I still get pork rinds at unbelievable volume and frequency in my locker. I've got a picture that, you know, we need to use on here about firefighters connectivity. They took and made a pork rind and potato man, and they made them hugging. And yeah, it was very, very nice. Somebody was even kind enough to make a t-shirt for one of the potatoes, which is dedication. But during that journey, you know, with physical injury in the fire service, and we talk about the different impacts through different segments on what it has on us as first responders and our family members. And we counted it up, I think, over late night adult beverages with one evening about how many first flights that I've had. The fire service has not been kind to me, but I think we came up to 5 times I've been trauma alerted in the fire service for injuries sustained on the job. And the being burned was just a redefining moment. You know, there is no pain in the world. You have the emotional, the spiritual loss, sickness, ailment, family, loved ones, spouses, kids. But physical injury, skin is a very underappreciated organ. And I would definitely underappreciate it. Having a skin ripped off your body for 3 weeks, 2.5 hours at a pop every single day. It's a redefining way to approach life. There's not enough pain medication and management to stop it. The process of returning back to work, as we talk with first responders, is no matter what the injury is, we're always driven to put ourselves second, whether we realize it or not. Now, we're selfish when it comes to always wanting to have the firefighter starter kit, the F-350 Platinum, and the big, you know, Contender or 36 Express. And, you know, your kid probably needs braces. For anybody who's on this that does that, go with the braces. Don't do the boat. That's a jerk move. But the interesting thing is we put ourselves second when it comes to really doing a self-analysis on where we're at. And the answer is always, yeah, I got that. Yep, I can do that. Don't worry about it. I'm fine. And returning back to work after physical injury or emotional, spiritual trauma, we're no different. Even sustaining moral injuries, we will get back on the truck and get on the rig for many different reasons. And with talking with firefighters, I found my reasons in retrospect were no different. I was concerned about health insurance. I was, you know, for my family, concerned about paying a mortgage, concerned it, secretly, can I still do the job? And I forced myself back. The recommendation, I think we looked at the notes one night, the recommendation was to take 1 year off from being a firefighter. And I was back in 6 weeks. I still had open grafts, weeping wounds, had to go beg the doctor to sign it. To get me back to work. It's an interesting thing returning back to work when you're still completely bandaged up from head to toe. Our HR and risk management apparently didn't read the notation on the case file, but they let me back on the truck anyways. The main key is, and one of the presentations that I do that if you guys are so inclined to listen to is called Honoring Our Scars. And it's Palm Beach County Fire Rescue was amazingly gracious enough to film this. Thank you, Sergio. And Palm Beach County's media division and their training chief and operations chief for supporting that mission. I'd encourage you to log on to the collaborative or the HERD group and click that link and then spend some time to talk about the evolution. One of the things is there's a lot of points that we find in first responders that we mimic each other. We set aside all the red flags, having nightmares, seeing things during the day that may not necessarily be there, drinking a 750 a rum every 2 days. The only time we engage is in obsessive compulsive behavior to distract away from the emotional and spiritual pain or the nightmares and flashbacks that we're having. And I was guilty of it. So Jeremy said, you know, as us not being the experts in the field, we may have an intimate knowledge that the experts we want to get you to may not have that basis entirely. But I went back and didn't tell anybody. And ultimately what that migrated into is nobody could read my mind. and I wasn't communicating. Now, my wife, who is an amazing woman, and my family really started seeing, and they talk about it openly now, about the pieces, the changes, the way that I was interacting, sleep habits, as they were shifting, they look back now and noticed. Now, one of the things in the family caregiver section that we talk about, and Jeremy and his wife did an amazing job, is about learning each other and be willing to talk to one another. It's a very scary thing to see your first responder, number one, injured. It's another thing to see their psychological platform that you're used to, their consistency, dismantled piece by piece. And that's what was happening. And ultimately, finding out, we're going to talk about what systems work here and they don't. The systems that we had were standard. They were normal for every other employee that was out there. And what we find, and we're going to talk about how those don't necessarily work for first responders, they failed. The system wasn't practiced. It had never been used the way that it was designed to. And quite frankly, it was the administration at the time. We have a wonderful administration now. The administration that we had at the time just grabbed the old brochure out, grabbed that EAP brochure and threw it. And the irony was they gave me the wrong darn one from 10 years back. And ultimately, I found out what it means. Reaching out for help, systematically trying to push through, using piss poor coping skills, and then losing hope. And what ended up ultimately happening was is I lost hope because the help that I reached out for wasn't able to address it, wasn't able to work with it. Hell, the counselors that I sat down with put them into tears. One of them was so panicked that she was sobbing, and afterwards she says, "I don't know what to do. Is there any way I can touch your scars?" So what we found is, what was missing is I lost hope. And when it transitioned into suicidal ideation, it's because I started believing in my heart that I wasn't able to help anyone else, that I'd lost my passion and I lost my sense of purpose. And being in control of my life and helping, thinking that I could help my family by providing for insurance, making sure my daughter had an education, didn't come home and didn't have to hear my wife sobbing at night because she couldn't and didn't know how to help me because I could not stop crying every shift, and I couldn't deal with the aggression, and she had no idea how much I was drinking. And it finally got to a point where the only way that I could fix it, because the professionals that I was going to, medical professionals, clinicians, psychologists, psychiatrists, we encourage you to go to them. And we have a wonderful list of individuals that get us that we're going to talk about here with you guys. The ones that I were going to didn't know how to handle me, didn't know how to work with first responders. We were causing more trauma to them than they were help and growth for me. So when I transitioned into that suicidality, it made sense to me because it was the first thing that I had control of. And I truly felt at that time that I was providing for my wife and daughter in a way that I no longer could do by removing myself in a way that would make them financially stable, that wouldn't cause them harm, that would allow them to finally get rest. Looking now, I know all of those things aren't true, irreparable pain and harm. But in that moment, in that time, in that cycle of spending almost 14 months in absolute turmoil and pain with no relief, I finally came to my own rescue, and it was the only choice that I saw. But it is astounding when we work with first responders now to know intimately what that feels like, and to approach it when you know what it feels like or you've had the impact in your life. To approach somebody without judgment is a very, very powerful tool, because we are human beings, and if you experience, it's not about the volume of trauma. Okay. 18 years in the fire service, specialty high risk, UCSI body recovery, a segment that we do to the clinicians. We play live videos of actual calls of me and involving in some really dark and graphic stuff to what the normal community would say. I've got one hell of a library, as do each of you here. So whether you have one day on or you're one day left, it's not about the amount and the volume and the quantity. It's about how those musical notes lined up in your life. And if you listen to that Honoring Your Scars, which we'll find out is the final trigger to my heart, was something lined up that meant something to me. Running a call on a burn patient that walked, talked, looked like me was that trigger. And the psyche is a powerful thing. Just as it can heal, it can also tear you apart shred from shred if you do not communicate. So the lesson that we give from this, and I hope that you guys take the time to log on to the Honoring Our Scars presentation, is that if we find even one reason for one moment to hold a thought in our head, in our heart, and don't communicate with our hope circle, our family around us, you are creating a building block and a path that will ultimately and can ultimately lead to the destruction of your support system, of your laughter, of your love, and ultimately of your life. So remember to communicate and get comfortable with the uncomfortable and talking about thoughts, feelings, and emotions. And remember, not everybody around you may be accepting of how you're speaking about it. So you may have to learn new ways to adapt to communicate so that other people are comfortable and safe. So Jeremy does a far better job on that segment explaining that than I do. But I'm going to go ahead and pass this back over.
I tell Dustin's story better than Dustin tells it. We were joking the other day, we were planning for this. I said, it's normally the segment that we have the honoring our scars. We have, the hour long segment. And when Dustin shares about it, he can share about it for quite some time. And, I made the comment that I can cover it in like 3 or 4 minutes. I don't know what the problem is. It's Dustin had some tough time going on in life and he's great now. It's great. Basically covers the whole thing. But one of the reasons I put that in there is because when I share about it, I obviously don't hit every point, but it's one of the motivating factors for me because of walking through Dustin in the aftermath of this, because Dustin and I didn't really know each other during this time. But David Dangerfield is where we got drawn together. And we mentioned earlier a little bit about that because of David's funeral that you saw there. In those pictures of David's funeral, it's literally Dustin and I, we're very small in there, but it's us sitting on that stage together. And the plan was, I'm going to do the eulogy, and Dustin's going to basically share some thoughts beforehand, and then I'll do the eulogy to finish. Because my assumption was, here's this guy who has just lost his best friend, and he's the chaplain, and he's the head of the honor guard commander. And so he's got a lot going on in his life, and I'll just be out there to help him. And then he gets up to talk, and then as typical Dustin, as I've gotten to know him since then, does a great job. Didn't even really need me to be up there on the stage. But, I got up there afterwards, and well, there's not really much left for me to say because he did a phenomenal job. But as we talked through the process of what happened with Dave, Dave was one of those people who helped you walk through your suicidal ideation and one of the people that really helped you. And this is really the part I go back to often when I talk about the lack of ability to truly prevent suicide when somebody's got it in their mind because you can't read it. Because I know, in talking to you, you did just about everything you could possibly do for Dave, short of literally like handcuffing him to somewhere where he can't go anywhere, because you had helped him find counselors and clinicians and walk through it and talk to him and vent it and all of those things. And then I know that the night he took his life, he was scheduled to have dinner with you, and he knew how to play the game to where you wouldn't even be able to know what was going on. And so I don't know if there's anything more really, I know there's some things you can add to that for us, but I know those two things have, your circumstance of being stopped, of somebody stepping in and stopping you from being able to complete suicide, and the loss of Dave, basically within a couple of years after that, really has bonded you and I together and has made this a passion we have. So I know that there's some other things you can share about that.
Absolutely.
Some of the challenges, looking through our lives and looking forward to other first responders that are seeking help, it is astounding how common it is for first responders to know the loopholes, the triggers, the things to say and not to say. David was very, very integral in the part of me continuing and seeking help, along with my family, with my wife Lynn, with my brother Will, with my parents. It was an all hands on deck type approach. And David was very proactive and encouraging. And it was one of those things, like when we talk about bringing mental wellness resources or a clinician into a fire station, is that when a first responder finds efficiency or efficacy with a program or a protocol or a practice or a procedure, it's amazing how many firefighters will go, hey, what's that like? What is it like to sit down and to talk about your feelings? What's it like to go to an IOP? Or what's it like to sit down with the sex therapist? What really happens? What really doesn't happen? And the conversation starts and initiates. And one of the challenges that we've found is, even when a first responder is interested or talking about and seeking help, and Dave was seeking help, that was one of the amazing things for David to be as supportive as he is and was with me seeking services and continually going to my counselor and making sure, sitting in the lobby to make sure that I actually went and attended, and to have him go through that process and start seeking professional counseling and regular counseling, and to see him re-engage and to sit down and have those questions, because this was an individual that was on a lot of those calls with me, those high acuity unusual, odd graphic calls. You know, most departments that will all have those calls that they say have the legendary pinnacle points. Hey, you remember 20 years ago when this happened? Or do you remember when? And it almost turns into to legend and lure. In Indian River County's history, we had a group of individuals, and we're a relatively young department. I think we're right at 110 years. It's a very, very young department in the grand scheme of the fire service, and in Florida for that matter. But some of those huge Sentinel calls as of later within the past 20 years that really made national news and were incredibly graphic and odd and unusual. And the irony is Dave and I were on the majority of those with several other crew members. I remember sitting down and having many conversations with them, you know, especially after, you know, I attempted to complete suicide, is the conversation that I see commonly. Thank God, you know, why didn't you tell me? And I thought it was only me. And that was the conversation that we were starting to have, is where he goes, man, I had no idea you were having difficulty, because I didn't want to talk about it because you always seemed fine. You know, family barbecues, doing stuff at the department, the extracurricular activities. You were always the one that was laughing and joyous. So we just got done cutting up some kids and putting them in a body bag and reshaping somebody's face because they went off a bridge and the parents wanted to do an ID. And you were Dustin, you were the one that was down there on the deck rinsing out bone and brain fragments, trying to reshape this kid's head, saying, hey, somebody give me a shirt. We need to make this kid look presentable. And then we're having a barbecue 12 hours later. So, you know, that was the interesting thing. He goes, man, I didn't want to say anything because you were always fine. You know, we'd get up in the morning, go out, go fishing, have a beer, do a barbecue, and you wouldn't say a damn thing. And it was only, hey, you good? Absolutely, I'm good. What's wrong with you? But as we transitioned into that pain cycle, it was very, very interesting how many times we've seen this with first responders, is where he really opened up. And he goes, man, I had no idea how difficult of a time you were having. He goes, and I was having the struggles too. I just didn't know I could speak. And that's why I'm so passionate about this, why Jeremy and I both talk about this, is look, after you have a tough call, and you know, each one of you knows on here something that was graphic, messed up, exceptional, or getting to know your crew, you know, maybe you just ran a call to hospice and you're not surprised by somebody passing and you're just going to confirm, or somebody, you know, just was diagnosed. Like an example, never, if you didn't know your crew, running a cancer patient or home hospice would never affect them because it wasn't anything that was exceptional, extraordinary, or odd. But getting to know your crew, that maybe their husband, maybe their wife, maybe somebody they love with all of their heart, was diagnosed, or had gone through treatment, and now it's intimate and it's personal.
Yeah.
Being willing after that call, it doesn't have to be this huge formal event. Activate your team. Everybody sit around the table. We're going to hug this out and snuggle with the struggle until somebody sobs, and we're going to move through this. No. Maybe it's just knowing your crew and sitting down and saying, hey, you know what? I know this person that you love with all your heart had a similar incident.
Yeah.
That seems like it could have been pretty similar. Are you okay? It's amazing how that happens and that works. But to the point and effect that we can't stop all completed suicides. You know, we sat down for dinner and cocktails, and we're working on a pond and hanging out. And I had no idea that a Bible that I had purchased for this guy, he was, you know, that I always joked and said, hey, you're just using it as a coaster to hold your whiskey up. It's a start. At least you're getting close to the word. But what I found is that same, you know, 3 weeks before he had completed suicide, he had highlighted all the scripture and put annotations in there on what he wanted me to say in his funeral. He'd already gone through and written down information to help expedite the process of getting care for his kids, and writing notes on every single thing and what he wanted to do with it. So no matter how much you communicate and connect, and even if you're asking the questions, you know, they've had therapy scheduled almost a year out after he completed suicide. Yeah. So it's about those individual incidents and things that may cause and contribute. But remember, continue to connect, but also continue to be prepared. That no matter how robust of a team you're building, you have, you want to design, or are in the process of building, that you are going to have those moments. And you know, in October, we had that moment. You never, as a chaplain or as a fellow firefighter, want to sit there in a morgue and hold your best friend's head up and want to just put the gray matter back in their skull. And I wonder how many of those things were good and positive memories, how much was laughter and love, and how many of those things were the nightmares that were haunting him, and trying not to feel guilty to say, well, at least they're not haunting him anymore. So communication and connectivity, and there's a couple other things here that Jeremy's going to share about some personal intimate loss, about recovery, growth, and pain that can still occur no matter how positive a life cycle seems. The part of being human and the human condition is, you know, there are mistakes that are made, there are growth that are made, and there's opportunities, but it doesn't mean it's without loss or pain.
Yeah, and I think these two stories, Dustin's story and Dave's story, are very very important to this conversation, because Dustin's is a story of, well, really hope and joy, really, in the end, because of what was done for you. And Dave's is a story of sorrow, just because of the fact that we weren't able to stop it. And this last picture and this last person that I want to talk about is Mark. Mark is a guy who got hired with my fire department years ago. I guess it was about 6 years ago now. And one of those young guys in the fire service who just did it all right. Studied hard, was getting ready for next promotion, was like the best of the best. I mean, he was built for this mentally and physically, emotionally, all the above, and did just a phenomenal job. And got to know him pretty well over the first year of his career. And then after he got through his first year, started getting to know him a little better, started to share some stories with me about his past and some things that had gone on. And he'd gone through some very, very difficult struggles in his life as a youngster, with some abuse that had happened from some distant relatives and that nobody knew about. And as a result of that, he really faced and struggled with some things that nobody expected, nobody knew about. And that's one of those things I want to remind you, is it's not just the fire service, it's your life. It's everything that's happening in it. And this is just, it just overwhelming, to the point where he really turned to a lot of other things, alcohol, drugs, all those things, and ended up in a recovery center as I believe a 21, 22 year old young man. Like, I'm a mess, because he had started when he was in his teenage years and was basically an addict at that point. Just couldn't do anything about it. Multiple recovery centers, finally found the one that fit and worked. Once again, a reminder of the fact it may not work the first time you're getting help. So be reminded of that. And the people you're helping, remember that as well. It may take a few attempts to get this done right. But what took place is he finally got the help, finally found the person who would help, finally found the group who would help. And then through that, got in shape physically, mentally, emotionally, and became a firefighter. Once again, became one of our best. And I don't say that just because he's not with us anymore, but he really was. He was one of those people that just everybody respected, everybody liked, from the oldest to the youngest member in our department. And what happened was he started going through some anxiety for a lot of different reasons. And through that circumstance, decided he needed to get a little bit of help, and he was seeking some counsel and some therapy. But one morning on the way out of work, decided to get in touch with somebody who he had not been in touch with for a long, long time. And he had been sober and clean for 8.5 years, I think, at the time. In fact, when we'd go hang out, he would just drink water, pound it, and he'd be the designated driver all the time, and he just wasn't going to touch that stuff. And for some reason, decided that morning that if he could just get a little hit of the drug he used, he'd be okay. And it was one he hadn't used in a long time, and he used it, and it killed him. It was an accidental overdose. And I walked through the next few weeks with his family. We had a lot of really amazing tributes at the funeral, and took him back to Colorado, where he was from, and we buried him out there. And I got to tell you, difficult thing. His family and I are close right now. We're as tight as I've been with any other family in my life. We will see them as long as all this pandemic stuff allows us to. We're going to be going out there to Colorado in June, and we'll be able to see his family for a little bit of time, and looking forward to that moment. But it doesn't change the fact that he's gone. And these are three different stories with three different endings, three different plot lines, and three different circumstances. But they're representative of people in your fire service. They're representative of people in the fire service around the country. And we want you to understand that there's a reason why we talk about this. There's a reason why we talk about mental health. There are people who are in Dustin's shoes. There are people who are right now in the situation Dustin was years ago, where there's no hope. It seems like the only way out is suicide. There are people in Dave's situation as well. And the difference between the two is, are we able to step in and stop it? Are we able to do it? And there are people who need that. And there are other people who have never once thought about taking their life, who are going along about their business, who make a poor decision. And a lot of times even that is just simply, how can I step into that? And there are many, many days, not a day goes by really, that I don't think about, man, I wish that on that day two and a half years ago, I was there in the morning to go, hey, Mark, let's go grab some breakfast, instead of wherever he was headed to do what he was going to do. I believe that this is a reminder for us that there are people in our fire service who need help. we can be that help to them. We can assist them.